These are African rhythms, passed down to us through ancient spirits. Feel the spirit, a unifying force. Come on, move with the spirit. Stand up, clap your hands. Move with the rhythms, get down.
From WSNC 90.5 FM and Broadcasting Service, an NPR affiliate of Winston-Salem State University, welcome to Africa World Nail Project. I'm your host and producer, James Pope. Today, we explore rhythms, vibrations, and Africana cultural production with Odyssey. Africa World Nail Project is next. I normally provide a textured, multi-leveled, and quite frankly, intentionally thick introduction for our programs. But today, we present a conversation I recently had with Amir Mohammed El Khalifa, aka Odyssey, as the conversation is itself textured, multi-leveled, and thick. The son of Sudanese and African-descended American parents, Odyssey was born and raised in Washington, D.C., spending summers in Khartoum, learning Arabic and swimming in the Nile. Growing up amidst the sounds of New York hip-hop, his father playing oud, go-go, and gospel, Amir took his first steps as an MC producer in the analog basement studio of his legendary neighbor, Gary Scheider, of Parliament Funkadelic. Known for his independence, Odyssey consistently debunks myths, stereotypes, and limited ideas of what an artist, creative curator is, or can become. Our show was produced today in solidarity with the Native, Indigenous, African, and Afro-descended communities at Standing Rock, Venezuela, Corporation Jackson in Jackson, Mississippi, Brazil, the Avalon Village in Detroit, Colombia, Kenya, Palestine, South Africa, and Ghana, and other places who are fighting for the protection of our land for the benefit of all peoples. Enjoy the program. Thank you for taking the time to join us today.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Oh, no problem. You know, this is a very fortunate opportunity for us to be having this conversation and to really, really kind of dig deep into, you know, the genealogy and also the work that you are doing now, which you've done in the past, but also, you know, kind of moving towards the future. You know, as I always like to do when engaging with folk we intentionally and selectively have on the program, I like to do something like that we call set the terms of engagement. What I wanted to do with you today is to map the strands of thought, the material and non-material influences in your work, for folk to get a more deeper understanding of who you are, who you were, and also who you're becoming. And the you I'm using here is not divorced from the collective. I do not intend it to be defined, the you to be defined as an individualistic or an individualist category of engagement, because with this conversation, I would like us to think out loud, or as I like to say, think black out loud about the points of continuity and symmetry that those who engage with you and your work can become aware of, to understand that you and the folk you work with stand in the tradition of creatives, collectives, curators, cultural producers who find waves in the manifestations of Africana cultural evolutions and produce ways of knowing. You're not just that what I guess the industry or our society would call, to at least to me, as a rapper, right, a musician, you know, that's not how I look at you. Sure. You're carrying on a genealogy of Don Cherry, Sun Ra, Alice Coltrane, John Coltrane, the Black Arts Movement, insurgent intellectuals who saw and see things most of us can't even see. You give it back to us in the rhythms. You are indeed an organizer of vibrations. And here I'm thinking Dilla. Right, I'm thinking, you know, the long genealogy of folk who hear things and see things that we don't necessarily, others can't see. For those who are listening, this conversation is intended to create a global collective point of congruence for which we can move in any direction and find ourselves through your work, to create ways of thinking and being through your work or from your work, to become more aware of the connectivity between us all, to see clearly the polyrhythmicity of culture, politics, art, language, ways of knowing of the Africana world in your work, through your work. I'm not sure if you see the same way. I'm not sure if you even see yourself in this particular genealogy, but that's the reason why we wanted to have this conversation today. Cool?
Sure. Sounds good to me.
So, you know, mapping your journey as an artist or a creative or, you know, a curator of Africana vibrations, as an organizer of rhythms, what does Africa, the diaspora, specifically your and your parents' ancestral and historical homelands, mean to you?
Everything. It means everything. It's the ingredients. It's one of the components that makes me who I am. It's one of the main ingredients in my existence, subconsciously, consciously, genetically, intellectually, historically, voluntarily imposed, everything. Africa means all of those things to me. To dive deeper into that definition, my mother is African-American. My mother is from Washington, D.C. She came there as a prisoner. Our ancestors did, my father is Sudanese and he came on a student visa. It was my mother's people who paved the way for my father's people to come. And I was born from those circumstances, and the music I listened to was born from those circumstances. The worlds that I simultaneously lived in were born from those circumstances. My parents divorced when I was very young, and I very much grew up in a bi-ethnic environment, multilingual, two different religions, two different out views of the world, and two different perspectives of self. And I grew up in between those two. So it is everything to me.
So you talk about, these two aspects of self, right? These growing up in these two environments. What were some of the ways that you reconciled those worlds? Because again, you're standing in a long genealogy and you actually talked about the ancestral and historical presence or in that continuity. What were some of the specific influences that you can recall that helped you find your voice as you were trying to reconcile, as you were reconciling these worlds, the languages, the religions, the forms of music, your environments? What are some of those things that you were doing that you can, that helped you kind of really helped you shape your voice?
Sure. I think the main thing that helped me navigate my particular circumstances was asking a lot of questions and having parents that were happy to answer them. And if they couldn't answer them, they would find the answers for me. And that was instilled in me at a very young age. And then I was encouraged to go find the answers myself. And oftentimes their answers differed for the same questions, or their reactions differed to similar circumstances. And observing those reactions and listening to those answers helped me understand what I realized now as an adult. Was I used to tell people I kind of had an off switch and an on switch, and I was able to flick it on and off when I was over my mother's house or my father's house, or when I spent my summers in Sudan versus my school year in America. My dad would send me back between the ages of 6 and 8 years old. I never spent a summer in America. So I used to tell friends and family and, people around me that I kind of had a switch of things that were not acceptable in the United States, I was fine with in Sudan, vice versa. When I now have the language for it, I was code switching. I was definitely code switching, and I lived a life of making everyone else who was born into one culture comfortable when they had stereotypical rants, points of prejudice, misunderstandings of one another, of immigrants versus natives, etc. I remained quiet and I listened and I code switched until I built up enough courage and strength and respect to have my opinion listened to.
That's a very interesting answer, because you talked about, we often do that, right? Growing up in these, certain environments, me being a person, having different worlds, coming from a a multi-world background, a multi-ethnic background myself, you know, being in those particular spaces, sometimes we tend to go too far into whatever the conditions are, right?
Yeah.
But also some of us kind of sit back, which also is very interesting, because this is something I think that those who are creative are able to view the world, to read the world in a different space, but to then give it back to us.
No, that's absolutely true. Those lessons taught me how to be a better business-minded artist, because I had years before I even considered music as an industry, I had years to understand people and just study people from two different sides of the world and study the people in between those two worlds in transit. And I didn't know how advantageous that would be until years later in my life, when I decided to do music as a career. And I said, wait a second, I know why people like what they like. I know why they eat what they eat. I know why they think what they think. And everyone thinks that what makes them is unique, until you're forced to see what makes others. And then you realize no one is really that unique. And you start to be able to use that and harness that knowledge and give it back to the world and say, hey, here's a shared experience of oppression on this side of the world with this side of the world. Turns out it's very similar and you're not alone. And I realized that I wasn't alone at a very young age as a result of that.
No, that's very interesting, because that actually brings me to a question that I think that kind of bridges two worlds, right? You mentioned oppression in one part of the world, but also this bridges into, you know, a question that I've always, you know, wanted to ask you as a person who has been, you know, pretty much a listener of your work for a while. And I will say, you know, I heard you before, but I will say Diamond District was one of those albums that was solidified you and, you know, you and your work in my mind of, like, you know, to this particular point. I don't know if you would say that, you know, you can address that if you want to before to this question.
Sure.
But
sure.
But yeah, I mean, you know, just listening to, you know, and it's funny because, you know, I have a 15-year-old son, Dean, and I told him that I was going to talk to you today, and he got excited. Right, because I raised them right. We listen to Number Tribe and Ozzy, you know what I mean? You know what I'm saying? But, you know, if you could respond to that, like, you know, that particular point, as, you know, in the context of, you know, understanding people, understanding what people like, but also being true to a certain principle that that is also relevant in your work that we'll get to as we continue this conversation. You know, can you talk a little bit about that period and you making that decision?
Sure. I mean, every musician, every artist, every creative has their own relationship with the balance between making music or making art that comes from a personal space for others. You know, it's a really, really strange relationship to have a personal attachment, such a personal attachment with your job or your career, only for it to its survival to be ensured by the critiquing and viewership of others, right? So I'm a fan of many things. And as we started this conversation off, I'm the sum of many things, as we all are. There's nothing special about that. I realized at a very early on point in my career that people are fans of specific things for specific reasons. And in order to survive as an independent artist who had to accept that I'm not going to make a lot of money doing any one thing a lot, i.e. I won't survive doing any one thing, because definitely wasn't about money for me. And it's not about money today, it's about survival. And I knew I wouldn't be able to survive doing one thing unless I was willing to compromise a large portion of my integrity or participate in the race and the competition that is Black music in the Western world. I didn't want to do any of those things. I was highly against them, philosophically and emotionally. You know, I was just against that. So I was touring. I've been touring since 2006. And my first tours out of the country were in Europe. And I started touring across the United States and just observing audiences. And it kind of like a lightning bolt moment hit me. And I realized I don't have to make one style of music. I have to make a lot of different styles of music and allow people to gravitate towards which style they like the most or their preference. As long as I'm at the epicenter of it, it doesn't really matter. So I just had a good long conversation in the studio sitting at my desk and said, I like jazz, I like hip hop, I like funk, I like R&B, I like bossa nova, I like fusion, I like acid jazz, I like psychedelic rock, I like all of these things. Why not just make them in some degree? They're all extensions of me, they're all things that I enjoy, they're all things that I appreciate. Why commit myself to just one of them? And it was around that time that I made an instrumental album called Rock Creek Park. And roughly around the same time, I made a group effort record called Diamond District. And for me, the Diamond District record was a classic boom bap golden era hip hop record at a time where many of my contemporaries were in a post Dilla electronic influence zone. And I saw nothing wrong with that sound. I love Flying Lotus, I love Hudson Mohawk, et cetera, After One back in those days. But I learned to exploit voids as a businessman. So I'm looking at the climate of music and I'm like, wow, things are very, very electronic. Now would be a good time to make a really analog record. It would stand out. That was step one. Step two was, let's make a boom bap record because I want that in my arsenal. I want that in my catalog. I want to be able to make jazz. I want to make instrumental records for people who don't like words when they listen to hip hop. I want to be able to tour with a live band eventually. I want to be able to license music and let it be syncable. I also want that fan base that loves vinyl and buys records and discuss who uses what break, et cetera. That's a whole niche community, but there are a substantial amount of them. And I could survive if all of these things line up. So I started on a path. My solo record, People Hear What They See, was very much fusion. It was a bit progressive, but still kind of focused around hip hop. Diamond District was my ultra boom bap hip hop record where lyrically I was probably the most misogynistic, the most violent, most profanity I use intentionally. And it was about shouting out Washington DC because I felt as though we didn't have that quintessential record in the 90s that made the rest of the country know our avenues, streets, bridges, and way of life like we knew of Atlanta, New York, Houston, Los Angeles, et cetera. So, and then I made Rock Creek Park, which was an instrumental record that was more towards the growing scene of instrumental hip hop and digestible, friendly, safe hip hop that was consumed by traditionally non-hip hop listeners. And all of those things combined, when they were finished and released out to the world, I found myself touring with Diamond District, but also touring by myself. So instead of 15 shows, it's the 30 shows. That's where I was in that space. It was about having as many things out as possible to survive.
No, and that's very interesting because, you know, as people are consuming this work, right, and you talked about the intentionality in what you were doing, but also, again, as I opened up our conversation, I talked about the polyrhythmicity of your work as well, being able to move it. That comes from a specific source, and we would call it an Africana source, and we talked about the ancestral and historical processes of moving throughout the world as you are moving throughout the world, but you're carrying, you know, these worldviews with you, right? You're carrying your home environment. You're carrying your Sudanese environment. You're carrying all these places and you're using this lens to be able to see the world, but to bring it together in these albums. And I think that is a very important segue into this particular question, because it's not only that you're listening to vibrations, right? You're not only getting vibrations from your environment. You're not only looking at the genres, and kind of seeing and moving into these spaces in between spaces Fred Moten would call it the undercommons, right? These other, these spaces in between spaces. And I try to look in those spaces as well. But what I thought was important, you know, as this is leading to this question, and this is, you know, I'm gonna try to read this question because I want it to be clear, but I also want to, I'm packing a lot in this question. What are you reading? Or when you are thinking about a project, do you, or are you reading something, or have you at any point, and what was it? And here I'm trying to unpack the material and non-material, the spiritual and intellectual influences in your work, because we're shifting in our conversation now. You know, and you know, in order for us to map your work, we have to understand these, but I also want to de-link this notion of reading. And here I'm drawing on Paulo Freire, the Brazilian activist, scholar, and thinker. And he wrote a piece called The Importance of the Act of Reading. And what he argues in this is that reading is not simply decoding the written word or written language, but rather anticipated by and extending into the knowledge of the world. He says reading the world precedes reading the word, but they have to be done together, right? Simultaneously, thinking and doing as a constant practice. Are you reading something? And again, not necessarily only in a literature word, but talk about that. Talk about that in the transitions.
Absolutely. I always take a journalistic approach to my writing style from the beginning. And the main thing I'm reading, and I'm constantly reading it, is the room. That room transforms itself from when I'm on stage. I'm reading the room the entire time. I'm usually on autopilot. My band and I, bless their hearts, we practice so much. I'm on autopilot on stage. I have in my band a lot of experienced musicians from theater, gospel, jazz. And a lot of the things that we talk about in the tour van are the act of theater and its importance in entertainment. So I say that to say, I learned to treat live performances as though they were plays, and that I'm reciting lines that I studied. That allows me to stay on autopilot when I'm performing and deliver the same performance, regardless if it's 10 to 100 to 10,000 people in front of me. That frees me up to read that room, to see you know, the moments that my band and I look for when someone in the crowd just puts their hands up and puts their hands behind their head and opens their eyes as wide as possible when they're like, just in awe of what they're seeing. I look for that moment when someone decides in the middle of a song that that's the time I want another beer because I've lost them. Or they look at their phone with no shame in the front row because I've lost them. Or the ages and the different reactions to different periods of my music, masculine, feminine, young, old. When this song comes on, this person barges up to the front. When this song comes on, they retreat to the back and another person comes to the front. When I don't play this song in this city, someone screams, play that song. And when I play that song in another city, someone says, I wish you would have played that other song. And why is it that Denver likes this song, but Los Angeles doesn't? Why is it that this rhythm is screamed out at this place and not at this place? Why is it that I gain their attention and they clap on this song, but not in this city? Let's take all of that information home. Why? What else are they listening to? What was big that summer or that winter? What is it in my catalog that makes them resonate? Language. Oftentimes when I'm in Europe, they're resonating more with the music because they can't understand the words. Even if they speak fluent English, they don't speak this English. As that goes to the extent of England, you know? My music verbally resonates the most in Washington, D.C. And I've seen it time and time again. Therefore, it's my favorite place to perform because everything that I'm saying is truly understood. Certain polyrhythms that I'll use from my influences of grime and broken beat and two-step in the U.K., I'll get an amazing reaction when we play those rhythms. And I don't get that reaction when I'm in D.C. I hit the go-go pocket in DC, they lose their mind. I hit it in New York, doesn't mean anything. I'm fascinated by that. I live in that space. I'm reading that space constantly and tweaking my work verbally and musically. And as you said, it's all Africa. Those polyrhythms, they're all when you break them down to their rudimentary level, they all come from someplace in Africa. And the combination of those polyrhythms makes other people resonate more. Now in Europe, where the Middle Eastern influence in Spain introduced a lot of Saharan and sub-Saharan rhythms in the Iberian Peninsula that went on to influence classical music, there's going to be certain polyrhythms that I pull from Sudanese music that coincidentally will resonate more in Europe, you know, whereas Yoruba or Igbo rhythms or Wolof rhythms from West Africa that I might use are identical to different pockets in go-go music. As a musician, I'm so blessed and appreciative that I hear those things. And I'm like, that go-go pocket is straight out of Africa. Like, I know a song here and here that's out right now that they are identical. And using those things to be like, oh, I could come out with a song that DC's gonna love and the Afrobeats community is gonna love at the exact same time, because I know why, because I know my history and I've read our music, you know? So I'm constantly reading.
No, that's very important, because as someone who travels to the continent myself, you know, multiple times, although this past year, I basically have been able to kind of, you know, sit back and take an assessment of myself, an assessment of my work, an assessment of, you know, things that I want to do, particularly in my life, you know, going to Brazil, taking students to Brazil and going to Salvador, Bahia, going to those particular places, going to Cuba, going to Santiago de Cuba, coming back. And so those polyrhythms and one of the things that our students gravitate towards the most is obviously the music, right? The music the context of that. So I'm very much, you know, appreciative of that as well. And you mentioned this, and I wonder if you can kind of elaborate on it, but you alluded to it. You alluded to some of the things that you're looking at when you're reading, you know, you're reading the room and you're listening to the vibrations. Are you listening to the sonic, the way that the sonic vibrations are hitting folk, right? Because that's what we're talking about, universality and universal rhythms, and how Africa, a deep rooted understanding of Africa, understood this, that it also can move the crowd, as we say in hip hop, right? You know, being able to do that, right? So could you talk a little bit about, you know, what are some specific things? You talked about those polyrhythms and you talked about the pocket and go-go, you know, me being in DC, growing up in Philadelphia and Richmond, Virginia, coming across, moving in different places, going across the world. I see those continuities as well. What are some other things, if you can elaborate on that, because it's a very important point, I think, that you're hitting on here when you're talking about reading and reading it expansively.
Sure. I mean, for better or for worse, we have a Western scale of music that was imposed on us, much like our language. The advantage of that is we all now speak to some degree similar musical languages as far as our emotional response to chord progressions and the placement and arrangement of notes. It's a more accurate universal language than English as a business language, you know? And reading those emotional responses to music is what I'm most interested in. Because when you can get someone to be emotionally connected to your music, you've created a fan. How can I get this music to make you conjure a memory or even make a memory to this music and then instill the association of this song with that memory? That means you and I now have a connection, and that's a lifelong connection. And those connections are fascinating because doesn't even have to be the best music. It just has to be the song playing at the right time, at the right moment, and the person associating that song or that melody with that moment and why. And watching audiences is just, it's amazing to see major and minor chords interact with people's feelings. And the best part is conversing with that audience after the show. You know, I sit out at my merch table until the last person's out the door, just talking to people. And it's like, thank you for this song or this song. I was here when I heard it.
We are listening to a recent conversation I had with Amir Muhammad El Khalifa, aka Odyssey, where we were exploring rhythms, vibrations, and Africana cultural production. The son of Sudanese and African-descended American parents, Odyssey was born and raised in Washington, D.C., spending summers in Khartoum learning Arabic and swimming in the Nile. Growing up amidst the sounds of New York hip-hop, his father played Arabic oud, go-go, and gospel. Amir took his first steps as an MC producer in the analog basement studio of his legendary neighbor, Gary Scheider, of Parliament Funkadelic. Known for his independence, Odyssey consistently debunks myths, stereotypes, and limited ideas of what an artist, creative, curator is or can become.
No, I sit out at my merch table until the last person's out the door, just talking to people. And it's like, thank you for this song or this song. I was here when I heard it. I was doing this when I heard it. I went back to that place. It got me through this period of time. It encouraged me to take this next step. And you have to be humbled by it and maintain your curiosity when you realize that some white German male was inspired to start a tech company when he heard the exact same song that an African-American soldier was listening to during a tour in Iraq that got him through his tour, that a Hispanic-American was listening to when they were studying to take their final exams to pass to get their degree. All true stories, by the way. All the same song. And you have to realize how much you don't matter, because you didn't make that song for specifically any one of those spaces. You made it from a completely different place, but how it was interpreted and very different by very different people. You have to be humbled by that and remain curious in that. And that's what I'm always reading. I'm always trying to understand how people make emotional connections to music, because understanding that is the greatest source of inspiration for me to continue to want to make new songs from the same 12 notes over and over and over.
That's dope, because I can't tell you how many times I wrote to your music, Trace. You know what I mean? You know, I played basketball to your music.
Right.
You know what I mean? You know what I mean?
Yeah. So,
you know, but you're right though. But also this is the reason why I wanted to have this conversation, because again, you're in this space, and I want people to understand that again, you know, you are producing ways of knowing. Right. You're taking multiple, again, these polyrhythms, and rhythms are not just musical, but the rhythms of knowing, the ways of being, and introducing an Africana way of being, giving it to the world. And it's producing all of these different ways and different emotional responses. Right. Sure. That's something that's very important, but also it's in a tradition of Africana storytellers. Right. through music, through words, you know, and this is indeed the tradition within which hip hop was born and will always live, no matter the attempts to distort it. Do you have a purpose, or do you intend to do? You mentioned the emotional responses, but I'm trying to see if we can, you know, if there is an intentionality, because you mentioned intentionality in your choices of words and concepts and ideas. You know, what are some of the vibrations? What is it that produce your choice of words? And I can't begin to tell you, I'm sorry, I'm going to have to do this, but I'm going to have to give you one of your lyrics. You know, it's actually from No Reservations, No Reservations. And you start that out. Well, if I could make time, I would make nothing else or anything else. I feel like with time, anything will probably make itself. Now, as a person who actually looks at time and not in a traditional, you know, people always say I have a problem with time, but I just don't move off of time with everybody else. That sure. resonated with me, right? You know, what is it that, you know, that you were thinking in that particular moment? But also you can talk about other moments of the intentionality. What are the vibrations? Sure. What were the vibrations that you heard? Did you have trouble with time just as I do? You know what I'm saying?
You know, I'm a super, super punctual person. I hate being late. And I'm very much an on-time person. I'm very methodical when it comes to things like that. But that line in particular touched on a couple different things. Me observing my family's relationship with time. And even though I'm a person who strives to be punctual, I don't measure my achievements by time. Time means nothing to me as far as a measurement of self. I want to be on time to an appointment. I want to be on time to a Zoom call, but that's not a measurement of me. Did I achieve something by a certain time? Should I be someplace financially by a certain time? Should I have this many listeners of a song by a certain time? Those things mean nothing to me. And that comes from my summers in Sudan, where every time I went over my family's homes, no one ever had a clock on the wall. Most people, maybe this generation does because there's a lot more influence from the West, but my father's generation, no one knows how old they are. They really don't. My father has to count on his fingers. He has like, let me see, I think I was born in this time, so I think I'm this age every year. And my aunt's the same way. There's no calendars. There's no clocks on the walls. People just kind of just move without time, for better or for worse. It's a big issue sometimes, getting things organized. But I really respected and appreciated this lack of importance on time in the Sudan. It didn't mean anything. Growing up, it was weird, especially when I started dating. That's when it kind of came to a head, was my birthday has always been a point of issue for my friends around me who didn't understand my upbringing. I never had a birthday growing up. It was never celebrated. I didn't know anything about celebrating birthdays. I saw it just kind of like, oh, that's just something that people do. It wasn't done for me. So as I got older and people were like, yo, what are we doing? I was like, I wasn't born today. I was born once. This means nothing. They're like, well, what are you talking about? Oh, you don't like getting old. This, right? That's what it is, right? I'm like, no, I wasn't born today. And we've got spring, summer, winter, fall to remind us that time is passing. We've got January 1st to remind us that time is passing. We've got bills to remind us that time is passing. Why do I need this other day to remind me that time is passing and I need to make everyone else pay attention to it? That came from my upbringing. The second part of that, also an influence from my upbringing, was my fascination with archaeology, human migration, genetic markers, evolution. That's my pastime outside of music. That's what I do the most reading on. And one of the things you learn from evolution is that with enough time, anything will make itself. And that's such a beautiful thing, that anything that is necessary will create itself from nothing or transform itself from something else with enough time, if you just leave it alone. If America was to finally leave Black people alone, not help us, not aid us, not give us a handicap, just leave us alone, we would evolve a fluent culture and society with no help. We've done it within record time, years, like a couple years after slavery was abolished. That was undone when they saw how fast we were able to elect people to Senate, create Black Wall Streets throughout the country. But just leave us alone. Just leave it alone. It'll sort itself out. Doesn't even need any aid. Doesn't need your health programs. Doesn't need anything. Leave it alone. We will figure it out. Everything does. Everything does when you just give it the freedom to be itself and evolve without that pressure. It will put pressure on itself. That's what that line means to me, is that time is of any importance. And if you really grasp that, if you leave things alone long enough, the results will come.
No, that's, it's funny that you say that, and you mentioned relationships and, all that particular stuff. And, time, I share that same perspective, yeah. Because it arrests being able to see things in between spaces, right? Mm-hmm. It arrests being able to create something in record time. If you just leave it alone, then yeah, things will move in a direction that they're supposed to move into. You know, which, and you mentioned this also, you mentioned memory, you know, before you talked about an emotional response to your work and linked to memory. And also memory is linked to a freedom principle that is divorced of time, meaning that, you know, we think about the Black Arts Movement, the progenitors of the movements argue that the Black arts must be created for the liberation of Black people, that must be connected to community, to the collective. And so here I'm throwing in a lot of things and I'm tying in a lot of things that you kind of said, you know, and folk can go back and listen to it to kind of see where the conversation is going, because there is some organization to this chaos. But also, you know, you mentioned this concept of time, this concept of liberation. Where do you see, or how do you see the Black Arts Movement, or what does it mean to you in the context of the work that you're doing? And the argument that the Black artists were making, a Black arts movement were making, that art must be created for the liberation of Black folk or Black people. What does that mean to you?
Sure. That's a difficult question for me to answer, because from what perspective of Blackness is it that needs liberation? And because the African-American struggle for equality and liberation has been so vocal and so documented, oftentimes Blackness has to become monolithic for the greater good. And this is something that, being from PG County, being half African American and half African American, you start to realize that for the greater good of Black progression, we have to almost be culturally monolithic. And I struggle with that, because I know that my experiences and places of privilege were not the norm. Therefore, my fights and my interest may not necessarily be identical with someone from Mobile, Alabama, or from some place where they're from a marginalized community where they very much felt like a minority. I never felt like a minority a day in my life, ever. Everyone was Black where I'm from. My teachers, doctors, lawyers, everyone. And then I went from that Black space to the Sudan, which translates to the land of the Blacks. Everything else was indifference to me for a very long time. I didn't understand other Black people's positions in the fight for equality in this country until I moved to New York 10 years ago. So it's unfortunate, in my opinion, that art is the savior of Black liberation. To me, it's a misfortune. And the reason why is because this country and so many other countries have not allowed us any other spaces to express ourselves as effectively as music or art. Therefore, we have to push all of our interest and desires and progress on the shoulders of our creatives, because we haven't been allowed to have our, look at the founding fathers of our country. They came from many different trades and became lawmakers and became politicians. We haven't been awarded that. So it all rests on our artists. And that's a misfortune to me, that our artists have to carry the burden. That speaks to the oppression and the limited bottlenecking resources that we have in this country and so many others.
No, that's a very interesting perspective. And as one that travels, right? You know, one who's been to the continent, one who's been to different places, you know, this limited notion of the purpose of art, I think, is what you're kind of hitting on here, right? You know, because I actually feel that we all are artists, right? We all are, intellectuals. We all are philosophers, you know, and your point is very well taken. And I'm also thinking about this in the context of, you know, freedom fighters, particularly from the continent of Africa, such as Amilcar Cabral and other folk. I'm thinking about, you know, art as being a tool for not as a supplement to liberation, looking back at the United States, right? And I think your response is a very textured response, and one that definitely, you know, warrants a very important meditation on, because it provides a different perspective, because I kind of see art as not this limited concept, as more of, ways of being that sure. can express itself through different ways. But, which brings me to, this particular question. Or did you want to respond to?
Well, no, it was in what you said. So many cultures around the world, the main focus of their art or music in specific, since I'm a musician, is entertainment. You find the most political art in the most politically turbulent places. And even in some politically turbulent places, you won't find political art. Sometimes because it's stifled by the government, other times because people are so oppressed that they sheerly use art as a form of escapism and do not want to be reminded of their hardships through their art. They want to escape through their art. And America is no exception to that. We've managed to have a balance between art that educates and entertains, that is to root us in reality and for us to escape, sheerly by the nature of blues and it being in the fabric of our music to have sorrow and hardship be entertaining, But I used to be baffled going back to Sudan and seeing military police everywhere and tanks and AK-47s and child soldiers. And this is the 90s. And I'm like, where's the political music? Why is every song about someone you love and someone you lost or someone you want to marry or someone you want to see again? How is every song about love? This doesn't even make any sense. Where's the song about there's no gas in a country that's oil rich? Where's the song about I don't have any bread today? Why aren't you all making these songs? Obviously, they weren't making these songs because if they did, they would be attacked by the government, And you look at that and you see that when not given the option to make political music, people find a way to use music as escapism. And that escapism, even still, is effective in helping them endure their circumstances without it even being intentional to be a liberatory music, And that's something that I noticed in Sudan, that there's a famous song called Azza. And the singer is talking about a woman that he loves and misses named Azza. The woman is actually Sudan, but he didn't want to call the song Sudan and get in trouble with the government, so he called it Azza. And after that song came out, one of the most famous names of girls after that song came out is Azza. I know a million Azzas, and everyone knows that Azza means Sudan, And it was so political and not political at the same time. It was a song about a loved one, and that's something that everyone can relate to. And I will oftentimes attack my writing from that perspective. So I don't consider myself a very outspoken, direct freedom fighter in the form of my music, if you get what I'm saying.
I absolutely do, because it seems like, it's when we talk about, escapism, I would say more of a, would you agree, or we can have the conversation, more of a future, being able to see beyond struggle. And that is basically the cultural production of music or literature is trying to move us to that particular point. And again, you worked, with the uprisings that happened in Internet not so long ago. You worked out Sada, and a fool we had on our program, of which we'll reach back out to again, So how important is it in the diaspora? How important is it for you as an artist of Sudanese ancestral background, El Sada of Sudanese ancestral background? How important is it for you to be able to bridge those forms of resistance, but also creating a future? Could you talk a little bit about that? Because that's what I see here.
Sure. Well, I'm doing my best to be the living example of possibility, so that when I encounter youth, I can tell them from my own personal experience that there are alternatives if they are interested in those alternatives. I by no means am some model citizen, but if someone admires something that I've done, I want to be able to tell them how I did it. And I want them to, if they want to be in that space eventually, I want to encourage them to do so through my art. It's like, obviously I can't have a conversation with everyone, but my music can. And I want to be that for people who listen to my work, because I didn't have that. And I see the benefits of having it being, you know, this, there weren't any examples of Sudanese musicians who rap for me to say, I can go against the wishes of my parents of, you know, they come from a developing country where there were no jobs for creatives. So they were encouraged to do jobs that would guarantee employment, engineering, doctors, lawyers, et cetera. Therefore, when they left that country and they went to seek a better life and opportunities for their children, they encouraged their children to take up those jobs and get educated in those spaces. And not because they innately knew that those were the best jobs, but those are the only jobs that would ensure survival where they came from. Lo and behold, they come to this new country where there are new opportunities that they can't see. They can't see that I can make a living being a graphic designer, because there was no living being a graphic designer where they come from. So I always take a very tangible approach to my art so that I can appeal and attract to so many other third culture kids to let them know this is a viable source of income and survival just like anything else. And I always take a very tangible approach for Black youth in this country to let them know you can make a living from music without being a superstar. It is possible. And there are a lot of different avenues to make a living in the music industry other than just being in front of the microphone. And those are things that are not, we're not given that knowledge openly. There's a lot of romance and myth and smoke and mirrors around the creative process that third culture kids are exposed to that their parents don't understand, that people who grow up in impoverished neighborhoods haven't had the privilege to even know exist. And I sit between the crossroads of both of those places. You know, my mother's from Southeast, my father's from East Africa. They sit between these spaces where I want them to know, I want my cousins in Southeast to know, you don't have to have millions of views and get a label deal to make money from the music industry. I want my Sudanese family, or even people who can relate, immigrants from India, from China, you know, anywhere where you can make a living from music, it's possible. You don't have to go to Harvard, Yale, Stanford. You don't have to go to MIT. You don't have to get a degree in law or be a doctor. You don't have to do these things. You can make a good living. And I want to expose that to as many people as possible.
No, you're actually speaking my language right now, because as a person who stands in the classroom, I'm constantly, you know, trying to.
No disrespect to education, by the way.
Oh yeah, no, I didn't take it as that. I didn't take it as that. But one of the things I tried to do is, because I don't view education or the classroom in a limited sense, right? Mm-hmm. I don't view the way that we think about knowledge production in this institutional form. I think about it as a cyclical process, as a mutual process of collective, you know, duties and responsibilities that we have to each other to create society to be better than it was yesterday. So for me, what I try to do, particularly in my classroom, is move away from grades, move away from content repetition or regurgitating content, but just how do we use our imaginations to create a world that we see in our minds, and how do we create a world to use our radical imagination, you know, to create, make a living, You know, you don't have to go to be teaching at HBCU. You don't have to major in business to go, you know, and what is majoring in business anyway? Like, what is it that you're going to do? You know what I'm saying? Right. Business. Like, what's your major? Business. You know what I mean? And my response, to students normally is like, well, you don't have to come to school to do that. You know what I'm saying? You could go,
try to start
a business, fail and succeed, you know, but the point being is that it goes back to what I was saying. You know, particularly the reason why I wanted to have this conversation is that you're producing ways of knowing. You're producing and standing in the genealogy of an Africana way of knowing the world, of creating the world and creating civilization to be just, to be peaceful, to be something more than what we see it in its current iteration. Right. Sure. And that's what I see, which goes to a question, you know, what are some of the spiritual, the non-material influences that you inscribe in your work? Do these influences kind of guide your creative processes of your work? Or, you know, can we see them? What are some of those non-material or spiritual influences that you know, that we find in your work?
Sure. That's a tricky question. Because I believe that everything is rooted in physical things, personally, you know? I think that even spirituality is rooted in physical things, because I'm a firm believer that science explains how and religion explains why, you know? So if there is some undefinable sense of motion that pushes me, I'm not satisfied with that. I need to know what is that undefinable thing. I think there are mysterious vibrations only to us for a short amount of time, unless we put effort to understanding where those things come from.
We are listening to a recent conversation I had with Amir Muhammad El Khalifa, aka Odyssey, where we were exploring rhythms, vibrations, and Africana cultural production. The son of Sudanese and African-descended American parents, Odyssey was born and raised in Washington, D.C., spending summers in Khartoum learning Arabic and swimming in the Nile. Growing up amidst the sounds of New York hip-hop, his father played Arabic oud, go-go, and gospel. Amir took his first steps as an MC producer in the analog basement studio of his legendary neighbor, Gary Scheider, of Parliament Funkadelic. Known for his independence, Odyssey consistently debunks myths, stereotypes, and limited ideas of what an artist, creative, curator is, or can become. Due to time constraints, you can listen to the entire program by accessing it through your favorite podcast platform. Just search Africa World Now Project. Strong, but then physically they visit me. Smaller printer, they too disappeared in me. But that ain't how I move. I just show and prove. Emotions filled with power, man, that's power I won't lose. Think I found my way. That's it for Africa World Now Project for this week. I would like to thank you for joining us today and look forward to spending time with you next week. We could be reached through all your regular social media platforms. Email africaworldnowproject@gmail.com or follow us on Twitter at AFWRLDNWPRJ or Instagram at Africa World Now Project. I'm your host and producer, James Pope. The Africa World Now Project Collective consists of international media journalist, executive producer, and human rights activist Moise Muntali, Africa World Now Project media correspondent Funa Ngonda, senior research, content contributor, and production director Dr. Tasneem Siddiqui, senior research, content contributor and production associate Dr. Josh Myers, associate producer and content contributor Dr. Keisha Khan Perry, technology advisor is Byron Gray of Grayworks Technologies, and creative director is Judah Pope. Africa World Now Project is heard every Wednesday at 7 p.m. on WSNC 90.5 FM NPR affiliate and broadcast service of Winston-Salem State University. Programs are archived and available on all podcast platforms. Search Africa World Now Project. Until next week, be safe, be peaceful, and above all, be intelligent. I think I found my weakness. I think I found my strength. And all that love and hate, they're one in the same.